Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Kristen's Corner, a podcast with your state senator, Kristen Phillips Hill. And today, I'm honored to have as my guest, Jennifer Storm, who is the Pennsylvania Victim Advocate. So, Jennifer, you've been in this position since 2013 when you were appointed by former Governor Corbett and then confirmed by the Senate. And I've been exceedingly grateful to work with you over my tenure as a state representative and now as a state senator to advance issues for those without a voice. So could you give our listeners a little bit of background about what you and your office does?
Thank you first for having me, and we're so excited to have you in the Senate now. Our office was created in 1995, really as a means to address the lack of victim services in the post-sentencing, post-conviction realm. So my staff, and we have 29 staff members, we really handle victims' rights once an offender is sentenced to the state system. So whether that's through incarceration, probation, and parole, their rights by law divert to our office. And those rights are the right to be informed, the right to be heard, the right to be notified. Obviously, victims' concerns don't go away once someone's sentenced, right? There can be almost like a safety lull that happens, but there are so many, you know, we have restitution that we want to monitor. There could be behaviors that are happening on behalf of the inmate where the victim's being contacted and they shouldn't be. So oftentimes we can intervene on the victim's behalf. But then obviously knowing that 80 to 90% of our population is parolable, there's that whole parole consideration process, and victims have a litany of rights at the consideration of parole. Of course, they have the right to be informed, they have the right to submit a statement, or now they have the right to come in and actually speak to the decision makers. And it's not always in opposition to parole. I think when people hear about victims' rights and having this opportunity to provide input, immediately people assume that the input is going to be negative or objection. And that's not always the case. Sometimes it is, I appreciate that this happened to me. I also know that there were factors involved in the offender's behavior. But I have certain conditions, safety concerns, that if and when this person is paroled, I want the board to know about these. And so we facilitate that right for them. By statute, I'm allowed to petition the board on behalf of survivors and victims to say just that. You know, they're fine with this person getting out, but maybe they don't want them in Cambria County. Maybe they don't want them in York County because of work and not wanting to see them. And so it's really important for victims to know that they always have rights throughout the whole continuum of the justice process so that we're meaningfully engaging them. And that's really what our office does. And we have a ton of programming that we do, both with victims, but also with inmates. People also just assume if we're the Office of Victim Advocate that we don't care about inmates, and that's nothing could be further from the truth. We feel a strong obligation to ensure that those that are coming into our correctional facilities are leaving better people. And so for that, we run a victim awareness class. We do a 26-week impact of crime class. We hold day of responsibility events across the Commonwealth. We go and we meet specifically with lifers groups to help them mentor the ones that are actually coming in and out of the prison. So we have a lot invested inside our state correctional institutions to make sure that we are creating awareness and sensitivity about victims' issues.
And that's really so important and a great transition because oftentimes there are people who are incarcerated who are in fact victims themselves. And I want to come back to that point because I think it's important. So this month is important for you, for me, and for many others throughout the County of York and the Commonwealth. It's Women's History Month. And I've seen a lot of really nice tributes for those strong women leaders and trailblazers, those who came before us, who sort of paved the way for people like you and me to serve in the capacities that we are in today. Just out of a little personal interest, do you identify any particular woman in your life who inspired you to do what you do, to be an advocate for those who really sometimes struggle to be their own advocate?
I think when I first came to Victim Services, I met Delilah Rumberg, who was the former CEO of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. And she really kind of took me under her wing and guided me when I was a very early executive director. And she was certainly someone I looked up to. She was very well respected, not just in the Commonwealth, but also nationally. She was contracted to do a ton of sexual violence work in the military, really probably being the first woman to walk into the ranks of the military and train on sexual assault and sexual violence prevention. So certainly she modeled and helped shape my career. I would be remiss if I didn't say I am one of three women who have held the position that I'm currently in. Mary Achilles being the first victim advocate of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, followed by Carol Lavery. So I feel very fortunate to be one of those three women. But certainly I think that, quite frankly, it's the survivors that I work with every day that constantly motivate me and propel me out of bed every day, because some days it's hard. This is not easy work all the time. But it's the strength and the resolve of those survivors and seeing what they've gone through and then watching them become advocates themselves. It's an honor to be their voice at times when they can't.
And I know how grateful they are to you for being that voice, or at least being their voice until they can find their voice. So switching gears back to what we had talked about earlier, and that is sometimes those who are incarcerated are victims themselves. And I think it's important to talk about that issue, given this month's significance and realizing that the importance of women in society. And that issue is human trafficking, and specifically the Buyer Beware Act, which is legislation that I've sponsored in the Senate. It's Senate Bill 60. And Representative Seth Grove, who's also from New York County, has introduced the same legislation in the House. It's House Bill 12. And it seems like in the past, individuals who were trafficked, who are predominantly women, although there can be some men and young boys who are trafficked as well, they were punished on counts of prostitution, drug charges, theft. However, the individual soliciting those services was not punished or sometimes didn't even receive as much as a slap on the wrist. And so in the news recently is the massage parlor in Jupiter, Florida, that was allegedly patronized by high-profile individuals with a lot of clout and a lot of wealth. And the parlor had women who were trafficked that were required to provide sexual services to the patrons. And this time, the storyline has been different. The story is about the patrons and not the individuals who were trafficked. And I think that's a really big departure from past years. So can you talk to the listeners, can you walk them through what's been done on human trafficking so far in the Pennsylvania legislature?
Yes, and I think in Pennsylvania, we were kind of playing catch up to our national counterparts and our other state counterparts. You know, we didn't even have human trafficking identified as a crime until Act 105. So, you know, we had Act 105 passed. That was really helpful. It's helping us identify. It created resources. It created the hotline that you now see at all of your turnpike stops and in other locations where we know there's a high rate of trafficking. And then we had to deal with the decriminalization. And I think this gets to your point about the media coverage. For so long, we talked about these victims as juvenile offenders, prostitutes, you know, women of the night. We were, you know, always looking at these individuals as though they were voluntarily coming to this situation. And that's not the case. And what we're learning now, that is oftentimes not the case. And so we had the safe harbor law. So we were able to decriminalize this behavior so that instead of shaming and blaming these women and in many instances these children, I can't stress enough how many of these individuals are children. They were being dealt with in the juvenile court. And I am proud to say in Pennsylvania, before we even had Safe Harbor, we had great courts and really good judges, Judge Dumas in Philadelphia, who recognized this and would really divert some of these juveniles out of the system and into care. But now Safe Harbor requires that. And so it's really about surrounding that individual, identifying them as the victim, and then surrounding them with resources to help get them out of this horrific, violent, torturous life. And so now I think what your bill is doing so importantly is saying, okay, we have a supply and demand issue, right? But we've only focused on the supply. And now it's time to look towards these individuals who are still willing to walk into a massage parlor and engage in a crime. And that's what it is. I think for so often, when we've looked statistically, our prostitution numbers have always exceeded our solicitation numbers. And that's quite concerning, because that means we're saying, as a prostitute, we're not looking at you as the victim, you're the criminal. But yet we're not going to put that same kind of color onto the person that's actually choosing to do this. And so I think what your bill is really going to do is going to shift that shame onto the people that are willing to engage in this criminal conduct. especially in a day and age where we know now that these are individuals who are most likely being drugged, who are being brutally beaten, who are being manipulated and tortured into this behavior, that this is not a voluntary act that someone is engaging in. So there were multiple criminal angles here. And so I think rightfully we are shifting the burden and the shame onto the individual who's willing to pay for this.
And I think you really understand the intent of what the Buyer Beware Act is doing, right? So punishing the individuals who patronize or solicit the services of someone who is trafficked rather than punishing that individual who is trafficked, who really, as you very accurately assessed, is a victim. So, you know, in my mind, in the spirit of Women's History Month, where there's really a concerted effort to recognize women and their accomplishments, and also I think to lift women up, we have so many individuals right here in our Commonwealth who are living in what I call modern day slavery. They don't have their freedom. They don't have their life. They are denied those essential constitutional rights that each of us is afforded. So if we want to end the issue of human trafficking, you're absolutely right. It's a business, and we need to remove that demand. Secretary Wetzel from the Department of Corrections recently sent me a New York Times article titled, "Behind Illicit Massage Parlors Lie a Vast Crime Network and Modern Indentured Servitude." And this article states that these pimps who are trafficking women in and out of massage parlors are using nonviolent forms of coercion. And the ring of these parlors totals over 9,000 across the country. They're in every state. And according to law enforcement officials, this is how they've quantified it. So these women who enter this human trafficking scheme are often indebted to their pimps based on false promises of hope and opportunity. And it's big money. It's really big money. And it truly is modern day slavery. So the Department of Corrections has been looking more and more at the issue of human trafficking, where women are being trafficked, identified from within the prison by these people who are their pimps. They send them money, they send them letters, they make great promises. They show up when they are released from prison, and these women find themselves, going from being incarcerated to being placed really into slavery. And so once these women are released, their pimp traffics them, and they fall into a horrific lifestyle that they struggle to escape. So what are you seeing on your end from women who leave state and county prisons and then reenter society? I know that Secretary Wetzel had spoken about the fact that, you know, we're putting together a working group to try and quantify this problem, and if we have this problem, what we can do to fix it. So can you talk a little bit more about those efforts?
We did. We had our first meeting last week. So we brought in FBI from across the Commonwealth. So we had folks from Allegheny, from the Central Region, from Philadelphia. And then we brought in the Intelligence Department of the Department of Corrections, a lot of analysts, a lot of data. And we started to look at how can we tackle this problem. And, you know, obviously data is important. And so we were looking at what type of data sets do we have access to? What do we need to analyze in order to really identify the people who might be at risk? So we have two institutions. We have Muncie and Cambridge Springs. So we're looking at, obviously, first and foremost, deposits into inmate accounts, right? That's the first red flag. If you see someone who has either a recent spike in you know, deposits into their account, or a real steady stream of money coming in, that's a red flag. That's somebody that you're going to want to look at. It's about getting the counselors and the staff trained. So we talked a lot about training. How do we identify women who are vulnerable or at risk? Do we know folks that are coming in, looking at their initial committing charge and seeing, is this a charge that's typically related to human trafficking? Is this a trafficking victim walking in with a criminal charge and then therefore is more vulnerable or susceptible? And then also, are we seeing individuals who are being recruited? And so fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, when you're incarcerated, everything is transparent. So mail can be read, mail will be reviewed, calls can be listened in on. And so what we're hoping to do is kind of use some of this data to try to get to these vulnerable populations and then provide them with education, with support. Within my office, and I've been very fortunate to work with Secretary Wetzel, I think he's one of the most progressive corrections leaders in the country. He truly gets victims' issues, and when he doesn't, he just says, Stormy, do it. And I like that. And so I had approached him a couple years ago and said, you know, we've got great policies regarding PREA, but when we're talking about actual institutional victimization beyond what it falls under PREA, we don't offer inmates anything. And so he said, all right, well, what's your solution? I said, well, I want a full-time staff person that can go into all of the institutions, meet with victims, identify victims when we know there's been an assault, whether it's inmate on inmate, staff on inmate on staff, that they're being provided their rights and services. Just because you're incarcerated doesn't mean you lose all of your rights and services. And so we are engaging her title is an institutional victim assistance coordinator. And so we're really engaging her with the FBI and with the folks at Muncie and Cambridge Springs to have her go in and start doing some education, making sure that in everything that we do, we're talking about human trafficking. We're letting people know about the signs. We want to educate these women as to what to look for. You know, because you're in prison. Someone starts writing you. They start complimenting you. They start offering to pay for things. These are, you know, this is attractive, right? And of course, they're not coming to you as a trafficker. They're coming to you as a friend or a potential love interest. And so they're establishing these bonds and these relationships with these women who are, quite frankly, already in vulnerable situations. And they're making them all these promises. And the next thing you know, they're a part of their reentry plan. And I can provide you housing and I can provide you a safe place to live upon release. And then, but what that woman doesn't realize is the release is, like as you indicated, it's going from incarceration to slavery. And the next thing they know, they're being drugged, they're being beaten, they're being tattooed, they're being forced into this servitude that is horrific and really hard to get out of.
And so hopeless. When we incarcerate people, I think our hope is that they will be rehabilitated, they'll go back out into the general population, that they will be contributing, productive members of society. And so to have people who go from incarceration back to being a victim in slavery, and their best hope would be to be back incarcerated again, because so many of these women lose their lives. And it's not right. But without real teeth to go after the root of the problem, ending the demand for trafficked women, we're going to constantly be fighting an uphill battle. So would like to know what you think about the Buyer Beware Act and how it's going to help end human trafficking in Pennsylvania.
I think it's about time, so thank you. And I do think it gets to the root of the problem. If we can make sure that individuals know that this conduct that which used to be acceptable and pled down, or let's be frank, oftentimes not even charged, is no longer acceptable and it's no longer tolerated, then I think we start to get to a place where then the demand goes away, or at least starts to reduce. And I think a lot of it is going to be education. A lot of it is going to be about talking about the fact that probably 8 times out of 10, if you're walking into one of these entities, you're encountering a person who is being trafficked. You're encountering a person who has probably been forced to do what she is about to do on you to 20 people that day. And that should make the average Pennsylvanian sick to their stomach. And so I think if we focus the criminalization on the demand, then hopefully we'll reduce that and we will save lives. Because as you said, far too many women die from this. I mean, this is no life. This is horrifically, horrifically violating. And the torture that these women experience often leads them to substance use disorders, because often, well, let's be honest, sometimes they're given the substance just to tolerate what they're being forced into do. So then they have these dependencies and then die from drug overdoses or die from suicide. If they can escape, thankfully we're finally starting to provide services, but this is a significant problem. And the problem lies in the person's mentality that thinks it's okay to go in and engage this behavior and pay for this behavior.
Well, Jennifer, I really appreciate today's incredibly important conversation and the feedback of the Office of Victim Advocate. And I especially want to thank you. Again, today's guest is Jennifer Storm, and she is our victim advocate here in the Commonwealth. So I'm exceedingly grateful for your leadership in speaking up for victims all across our Commonwealth. And I would like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in to another edition of Kristen's Corner. And for more information, please visit my website at www.senatorkristen.com. Thank you.